Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national and local focus on gender, sexuality and feminism.
Hi, I'm Donna Bridges, Senior Lecturer at Charles Sturt University. Our program today is about self-determination of women in the Anglican Church in Australia. The traditional position of the Christian Church has held that women should be subordinate to men, and historically women were denied a place in church leadership and positions of power. Early feminist critiques of the church centred on the role of religion in perpetuating inequalities between the genders and challenged the belief that women were inferior to men or a temptation to them. A lot has changed, and women have sought a place in the church as priests, ministers and pastors, as theologians and teachers. Some scholars go as far to claim that the modern-day church would collapse without women, but their place is often subordinated and seen as merely a support role. Australian Anglican dioceses have recently celebrated the 30-year anniversary of the ordination of their first women priests. Women clergy are now a quarter of all Anglican priests in Australia. There are 7 women bishops across the country, and in Perth, a woman archbishop. However, the 3 dioceses that remain unliberated represent literally hundreds of churches where women are denied leadership positions and are not recognised as priests. Even the Archbishop of Perth would not be recognised within them. There's still a long way to go. Only a quarter of parishes are led by women, and many women are living under the shadow of conservative, complementarian ideology. I have 2 special guests today who have a great deal of knowledge about gender matters concerning the Anglican Church in Australia, both personally and as scholars. Reverend Wendy Pullen has been an ordained priest in the Anglican Church in Australia for 25 years. Wendy described her role as a priest as not only a vocation but a true expression of herself. Wendy has a parish in Greater Melbourne, and in this role is very much part of church leadership. Our other guest is Nicola Locke, who is a lecturer of pastoral counselling and professional supervision in the School of Theology here at Charles Sturt. Nicky's also a counsellor in private practice and consults with church bodies internationally concerning policy development in responding to domestic violence and the provision of professional supervision for church workers. Nicky and Wendy, thank you so much for being with us today. I'll start today by asking Wendy about some of the hurdles she encountered on her very long journey to becoming a priest.
Hi there, Donna. I really love looking back, considering the journey that I've come on, and I'm looking forward to sharing some of that with you today.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, Wendy, you told me part of your story about being called to be a priest. You walked into a church when you were 17 because you wanted a role in the church, but it took you until you were 51 years old to realise your dream. Can you tell us a little bit about that journey?
Yes, I think you'd have to say I'm a bit of a late starter, wouldn't you, when it comes to getting that collar around my neck. I was a child of the 1950s church, absolutely reared in all of the things that happened then. Sunday school, girls' friendly society, the Anglican society at university when I eventually got there. And when I was 17, I felt that God was calling me to something in the church. It was really something that I couldn't name at that time. I certainly didn't think that I was being called to be a priest. And that was, I think, because no woman was a priest in Australia at that time. It was just simply not something that was in anyone's consciousness. There were no role models. And the notion that you might be called to something in the church usually translated to the suggestion that you be a missionary, or perhaps you might be a deaconess, which is not the same as a deacon and really is a lesser position. But I have a male colleague who's about to celebrate his 50th year of ordination, and he and I are exactly the same age. And when I think back on it, I realise that, you know, my offer to ministry was not something that anybody embraced with any great joy or enthusiasm. And that would have been very different to the way they treated the male colleague. He would have been seen as something as a prize. So there are big differences between what men could do and what women could do, and I've certainly experienced that.
Wendy, your husband was a priest and members of his family were priests. What was the response then to your announcement that you too were to be ordained?
I don't know that it was met with unmitigated joy. I think that although I married someone who had a bit of a dynasty, I don't think that really there was any great expectation that the women of the family would follow suit. I think that the more acceptable role, perhaps certainly when I was in my 20s, would have been really to be the wife of a priest who was seen as the priest's helpmate, someone who'd lead the women of the parish, if you like, go to the women's guild, lead the mothers' union, support their ministry. They were very much seen to be in a support role if they were married to an ordained person. And I was fortunate because Christopher was on my side, and he, I think, in many ways made it easy for me to study, whereas perhaps others in the family or beyond it might have thought it was decidedly unusual for a parent of five children to head off in the direction of theology.
And what was your experience of the fight that was going on in Australia and around the world at the time, where Anglican women wanted to become priests and there was resistance and it was a long journey for people? So what was your experience of that?
It was probably in the late 80s that I really became aware of the debate that was going on about women in ministry. I'd heard of the movement for the ordination of women, which was agitating for change. I started listening a lot to the radio, to the debate as it was on ABC radio particularly. And I remember one day listening to a male priest discussing the upset that would be caused to the church if women were ordained, and the equally difficult upset that would be caused if they weren't. Someone suggested to him that if women were not ordained, then the women of the church would leave the church. It was a time when feminism was really starting to bite, I guess. And his response was, well, if women leave the church in disgust because we won't let them be leaders, if women have to be sacrificed in the cause of truth, well, let it be. You know, I can remember being riveted by that comment. I've remembered it all these years. And so I started to first advocate for other women, arguing that they at least had the right to test their vocation so that the church could hear why it was they felt that they were called. And then not long after that, I went on a trip to the Holy Land and did a course at St. George's College there, where I met a woman Episcopal priest, someone from the United States, and I, for the first time, experienced the ministry of women. And she encouraged me to think about priesthood. And I certainly did that. If priesthood had been available to me when I was 17, if that had been something possible, then I think that that would have been the thing that God was calling me to. I decided to come home and enrol in theology, and I did that. I had to do it entirely by distance because I lived in South Australia and in the country where there was no opportunity to study. And there was no support either. So the cost of that course was something that we had to, as a family, bear ourselves, and we had only one income. So I could only study for the number of subjects we could afford to pay for in any given year. And it also meant that my progress through a Bachelor of Divinity was very slow. It just completely hinged on finances.
How long did it take in the end?
It took me, I think, 5 years to do that degree, if I was fortunate. It was really hard, yeah. Hard to do. And there, I suppose the other thing was that it was very hard to convince bishops at that time that a woman was genuinely called. You know, there was a hurdle. It was all right to study theology, but that was absolutely no guarantee that you'd be ordained or accepted as a candidate.
Thanks, Wendy. Your reflections recount many hurdles on your path, and you did overcome them, and this in itself represents success. There's a lot to celebrate, a lot of positive change. But still some significant challenges. Nikki, can you tell us about the remaining pockets of conservatism, particularly the ethos of complementarianism that continues to interfere with women's equality in the Anglican Church?
Yes, so in the Anglican Church in Australia, we have 23 dioceses, and three of the dioceses would hold a very conservative position around the relationships of men and women, a position which is called complementarian theology. And what it means in those dioceses where that theology holds sway is the teaching that comes from the pulpit refers to this idea of men basically having authority and women needing to submit to that authority. And it also affects whether women can be fully what's called priested or ordained in those dioceses. And in fact, in the three conservative dioceses in Australia, women cannot become priests, which means they can't be in charge of a church, they can't celebrate Holy Communion, and largely they're not able to teach and preach in those churches. So they're very limited in their roles in the church in these three conservative dioceses.
And what are the consequences of this for gender relations between men and women, Nikki?
Well, I think the consequences are wide and varied, and they may be not fully realised. But from a very, let's say, from a very first point of view, what happens when you're a member of a church who holds this theology is that you will only ever see men in leadership, and you will only hear teaching about the Bible from men, which obviously is going to give a particular view of teaching when you're only hearing teaching by men. It also impacts relationships within marriage. So there's this idea that the man is in charge in the marriage and the woman needs to submit to his loving leadership. And we know that that position contributes to domestic violence situations because women believe that they need to submit to their husband's leadership. And that extends even sometimes into abusive situations. Beyond that, because there is teaching that says one of the reasons we don't believe that women should be in leadership is because of, in the story of Adam and Eve, that Eve was deceived first, women are somehow untrustworthy. So there's a sort of general sense of women being in some way second rate in these churches, even though the actual position that is taught by in complementarian theology is that men and women are equal before God, but the practical outworking of the theology means that men and women don't appear to be equal before God. And complementarian theology will clearly state that men and women have different roles in life. That's why men have the authority position and women have the responding to that authority position.
Nikki, does complementarianism have a basis in the Bible?
It's based on an interpretation of certain Bible passages within the Bible, and they would take certain Bible passages beginning in the very first books of the Bible, in the creation story, through to the teachings, particularly the teachings of Paul in the New Testament. They take particular passages and say that when we interpret these passages, the interpretation of these passages supports our position. There is, of course, an opposite view, and that would be the egalitarian view. And this was really strengthened by another body called Christians for Biblical Equality, who hold that men and women are truly equal, they're truly able to fulfill any role in the church, any role in leadership. Men and women are able to teach. In fact, what they should be doing is they should be ministering within the church according to their gifting, and that men and women should be equal in marriage, and there is no idea of headship and submission from an egalitarian perspective. And that position is also supported by interpretations of Scripture.
To understand more about the issues on a deeply personal level, you did a research project at Charles Sturt, Nikki. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, so I conducted a small collaborative inquiry project with a group of four women who all are working in various ways for the church or parachurch organisations. And what it costs them to be involved with the Conservative Church where women's roles are limited. My research was sparked when I was at a seminar on domestic violence, and one of the speakers on the panel talked about crying in her wardrobe on many occasions because she was not allowed to preach at her own church because of the various beliefs that her church and her minister in her church held, and how painful that was for her. And I guess that sparked my interest to think about what is it costing women emotionally where they're limited and what it is they're able to say and allowed to say.
Thank you, Nikki. That really is food for thought. And my final question to you both today is, what is your advice to women who are being told in their own parishes that they can't preach and that they can't teach unless those that they're preaching to or teaching are under 12 years of age? Many don't want to leave their parishes, so what can they do? Wendy?
I think that's a vexed question. You know, I'm fortunate after 25 years of ministry to be able to look at those situations now and to feel that it's time for women to really be encouraging other women to simply not listen to those arguments, to dismiss those arguments from the male people who are trying to hold them back from something to which God is calling them. I know, looking at my own ministry, that it's been a fruitful ministry, that I have been enabled to preach and to teach and to lead. And for all those years, I've done it successfully. And I think that what that does is show the validity of the sense of call that I had. And I think it's the same for every woman. If God is calling a woman, they should simply get on with it and really not go into combat with arrogant people who want to put them down and have them in a secondary position. I think often people who hold that view that's opposed to mine love a fight, and I've decided not to bother. I'm not going to fight with someone about the validity of my ministry or any other woman's, because it's valid by the mere fact that we're called and that we want to answer that. And I'd rather extinguish the fighting voices by not replying to them.
Fantastic advice, thank you. And thanks for being here with us today, Reverend Wendy Pullen.
Thanks, Donna. So good to talk to you.
And Nikki, what's your advice?
I think first and foremost is women need to be true to their relationship with God and seeking guidance and succor through their relationship with God. For myself, obviously, I've chosen to be on the Committee for Christians for Biblical Equality in Sydney. I've chosen to take an advocacy role around this position of complementarian theology in a conservative diocese. I've made this decision that I'm now in my 60s. I've made the decision that I'm no longer going to self-silence. I'm actually going to be open about my egalitarian position, even though I know that that will cost me certain relationships to take that position. But I think women really need to start thinking about this. And maybe sometimes in church, it's easy for men and women to sit in church and not really think too much about how do we treat men and women in our church. You know, the church may be going well, it may be a friendly place, it may be doing some really good works in the community, but there's a sort of passive avoidance of what does this church really believe about men and women, and what is that doing to men and women, because we subscribe to this church as a body subscribes to this complementarian theology whereby women are very restricted. So I would encourage people to be thinking and talking about it more, to pray, to read the Bible. If they're in a church where they only hear the complementarian theology message, to actually understand, to discover and understand that there is a very valid scriptural argument for fully egalitarian relationships between men and women. But it's also empowering to have the message out there that there are some issues here that need to be addressed. And it gives a foundation, I think, for conversations to start or to continue, because the conversation has always been there. There is a strong egalitarian position, both nationally and worldwide. How do we continue the conversation about what is a right understanding of men and women's relationships? Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak about this, because CBE, which I'm a part of, we have really determined that we are committed to respectful dialogue, that we believe that respectful dialogue is a way forward here. And so having this platform here is an opportunity for you and I to have some respectful dialogue, but I hope it also informs the listeners for them to have respectful dialogue in the various places where they are.
I'm sure we're reaching out to people today. So thank you, Nikki.
Thanks, Donna.
I'm now joined by my co-host, Cliff Lewis, to ponder some of the insights that Wendy and Nikki raised today. What's clear to me, Cliff, is that religion has an important role in both Wendy and Nikki's lives, and that they're looking for an experience that aligns with their faith and with their ethics. And this is an issue for a lot of people today. But church attendance in Australia has been declining over the decades, and even Pentecostal churches like Hillsong that were growing have been seen in the recent census to be in decline in membership. It is thought that leadership abuses and gender inequality are the likely causes of these declines. People want their religion to be relevant in their lives, and equality and inclusion are the obvious ways forward. Relevance to me means more inclusive gender hierarchies, where women have a role in leadership and decision making. This is important to people, Cliff, because the traditional model of church hierarchy has been implicated in abuse, as Nikki pointed out, with domestic violence. And the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse has meant that all religions have lost some trust in the population. And some people have questioned the moral compass that the church can have on these issues. So, inclusion creates diversity, and diversity has been shown to improve gender relations and forms of inequality that can impact on people who have diverse sexual orientations and gender identity. What are your thoughts, Cliff, from an LGBTQ perspective?
Thank you, Donna. Yes, we are at an interesting point in society and the role of the church in it. Statistically, 1 in 10 people identify with a diverse sexual orientation as being either lesbian, gay, bisexual, or some form of diverse sexual orientation. And perhaps this number may continue to grow as there's greater social acceptance and more people feel comfortable being themselves. We can see that the number of religious and church groups represented in the Mardi Gras keeps on growing every year. We now have Anglican floats, we have Catholic groups. We've also got initiatives in Sydney to support LGBT people. For instance, Acceptance in Sydney, which is a faith-based community, supporting gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Catholics. Given the significance and movement, we are at the point where the church hierarchy needs to acknowledge the presence of LGBT people, because many of us do go to church and want that meaningful relationship with their faith and the community that it provides. A Jesuit in the United States, Father James Martin, calls for mutual respect on both sides, that is, from the perspective of the church towards LGBTQ plus people, and vice versa. And perhaps it is time for meaningful dialogue to carry religious institutions into the future in a way that considers the diverse voices of its congregation.
That's right, Cliff. We can't assume that because of declining numbers that people are losing their spirituality or their faith. As both Nikki and Wendy emphasise, religion serves an important role in many people's lives. So perhaps it's up to the churches to be more open and more accepting and to increase their relevance.
Thank you for listening. This show is brought to you by the Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google the Gender Network at Charles Sturt.